wear and tear today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. We like our fashion fast and cheap, but it comes at a price, like clothing factories moving from North Carolina to places overseas.
I hope and pray. I live to see today that a lot of it comes back. I think it can. I've always been an optimist.
Wear and Tear, our series about the women who make our clothes around the globe, plus how a U.S. medic on a chopper helped save the life of a North Korean soldier.
And he told me he actually said a prayer when he first saw the soldier because he did not think that he would even survive the flight.
And how the promise of better food helped lure Soviet scientists to Siberia.
They could have caviar and also fruit, a variety of meats and sausages and cheese.
Food for science in Siberia, that's ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Thanks for making it here this Monday. There may be no better way to understand the connections between us Americans and the rest of the world than the clothes we wear. And this week on the show, it's all about the tag. You know, the tag on that shirt you're wearing or the one in that sweater you're planning to buy as a gift for the holidays. What country does it say it comes from? And what does that tell you about the people who actually made it? You may not know this, but the textile industry worldwide employs mostly women. So all this week, our Across Women's Lives desk is bringing you the stories of the women who make our clothes. We'll hear from textile workers in Bangladesh later in the week. Today, we start right here in the U.S., in a place where America's clothing used to be made. Here's The World's Jasmine Garz with our first story from Roanoke Rapids, North Carolina.
In Roanoke Rapids, people like to tell this story about how a long time ago, in the middle of summer, it used to snow a little. It would float down and stick to your hair and the cars and the people running off with someplace to be. The town was bustling back then.
It was busy and thriving, yes. We had a downtown and an uptown.
It wasn't snow. It was cotton floating out from the textile mills. This was before air conditioning, and the factories would open their windows to let a breeze in. Hickory Lassiter is 89 years old, and she remembers those days.
My daddy was a sharecropper.
She's from a big family, 16 brothers and sisters.
And I couldn't go to college, couldn't do anything but go to work.
What little money they had always went to the boys.
My daddy never gave us girls any money, but he would give the boys money. So I used to wonder, well, why doesn't he give us something?
Then, in the 1940s, everything changed for American households.
America goes to war. Men of the Army, Navy, and Marines reinforce the battlefronts on six continents.
The U.S. joined the war, and Akri's brothers went off to fight. Akri had to get a job at the mill. She was 17.
The first week I worked for 40 hours, guess what I got? 40 cents an hour, I got $16. I was called a creeler. You'd have things of yarn about this large, and you'd put so many of one color here and so many of one color here.
In these mills, they made clothes. They made towels. They made tablecloths. If it could be made out of cotton, they made it.
And it was good to be making money, you know, and taking care of yourself.
Akri remembers buying her first car, and she remembers renting her own room near the mill. Millwork was hard, though, and for most workers, the money didn't go that far. As the years passed, Akri says they could feel the foreign competition coming on. She remembers her boss telling them that they needed to do better.
He said, because in China, they can make the same towel, I'll say, for $2, where
everybody used to call us lint dodgers and river rats because we lived on the Roanoke River. But lint dodgers, that's the first thing they'd tell us that we were.
Lint dodgers. Phil Huds, an insurance agent, remembers getting called that as a kid. This town was known for one thing, its cotton mills.
If you lived here, born here, somebody in your family worked in the cotton mill. I mean, one time it was 6,000 people here and that worked in these mills. From the very poor to the well-off.
I meet Phil Huds and his friends at the town diner, Oscar's.
Yeah, I want a three-egg omelet with hoop cheese.
Oscar's has been here since 1953. It used to serve the workers breakfast, lunch, dinner. This town never slept because the mill never slept. It was a 24-hour operation. Sitting at this breakfast table is a guy who knows everything about this town's history and the mills. His name is Rex Steinbach.
There's still a lot of really, really good people here. Really good people.
Rex Steinbach is a police officer, and he adores this town. He would describe himself as a hobby historian. And today after breakfast, he's offered to drive me to one of the old textile mills. It was built in the 1920s. It's one of the last left standing. Inside, it's an exquisite carcass of industry. Massive, beautifully built, and completely empty and dark. Windows broken and roof leaking.
It's sort of peaceful to me. I like old stuff like this.
What would it have looked like if I had come here, like, 1960s?
It would have been a really, really loud plant here because the weave machines were deafeningly loud. Everyone here wore earplugs. And the place ran 7 days a week at times, 24 hours a day.
Now all I can hear is the buzz of old fluorescent lights. Rex calls me over. In his hands are these yellowed, grease-stained papers.
What did you find? What did you find here?
The company safety rules. It's dirty.
Wow.
Look at my fingers. They're just nasty. It was in the bottom of that drawer.
Smoking in unauthorized areas. Failing to report accidents. Yeah. Failing to wear required personnel.
What happened here in Roanoke Rapids? Some people blame the unions. In fact, you can't even say the word union here without starting an argument. Also, competition from abroad, like Acree's boss had warned. Places like China and Bangladesh began making textiles that were so much cheaper. Back at her house, Acree Lassiter tells me she hopes President Trump can bring industry back to Roanoke Rapids.
I hope and pray. I live to see today that a lot of it comes back.
Do you think it can come back? Do you have hope?
I think it can. I've always been an optimist.
But she says when she was driving through town a few years back and she saw the mill where she'd worked for all those years being demolished.
And I stopped my vehicle. I couldn't believe they were tearing it down. And it just did something to my heart. And I sat there and I thought, oh, my God. God, they're tearing it down.
One of the demolition crew guys told her she could come in and try and find her old work desk. If she could find it, she could take it home as a memento.
And I went down there, but I couldn't find it. I couldn't find it.
For The World, I'm Jasmine Garst in Roanoke Rapids, North Carolina.
Tomorrow, Jasmine takes us to one American city where the textile industry is still booming. In Los Angeles, sweatshops employ thousands of immigrants to make your clothing. Sweatshop USA, that's tomorrow right here on The World. And remember what I said earlier about what you can learn from the tags on your clothes? Well, we've built an online tool that lets you grade your clothes. You enter the info from the tag, and we provide you some insight into how that item was made. So go to PRI.org, and let's figure out how fair is your fashion. Let's follow up on a video that went viral a couple of weeks ago. You might have seen it. It is pretty incredible. It showed a North Korean soldier in the act of defecting across the demilitarized zone between North and South Korea. The soldier is seen running for his life as other North Korean soldiers shoot at him. The defector is wounded multiple times, but miraculously seems to make it across. So what happened after that? Anna Feifeld is a reporter with The Washington Post. So, Anna, the soldier was 24 years old. We know at this point that he was injured in the shooting. Tell us how troops in South Korea found him and what did happen next.
Even though he'd been shot five times, he managed to drag or crawl himself to safety behind a building and kind of down a slope. It was very difficult to find him. And in fact, part of the reason it took the South Korean troops half an hour to find him is because they had to point the thermal cameras in a different direction to even pick up his body and figure out where he'd gone to. So then the South Korean soldiers crawled over to drag him out from there. And then we know that after that, an American medevac crew, which had been on standby at a base nearby at the DMZ, Lindsay was called and told to come and get him out.
He nearly died in that helicopter. How is he doing now? Where did they end up taking him?
They took him to a trauma hospital south of Seoul. It was about 22 minutes in the air, which is apparently a very long time in the air or a long journey to keep somebody alive. And I spoke to the U.S. Army medic who looked after him in the helicopter, and he told me he actually said a prayer when he first saw the soldier because he did not think that he would even survive the flight. Well, he did survive the flight thanks to that American medic putting a big needle into his chest to let the air out. And then he was operated on several times by a very renowned trauma surgeon in South Korea. It was still touch and go for quite a few days there, but now we hear he's stable, he's sitting up in bed in his hospital room, and he's expected to make a proper recovery.
What is the name of this North Korean soldier who's now defected?
His name is Oh Chung-sung. He is 24 years old. We think that he came from a military family in North Korea. And generally, the fact that he was serving there on the front line with South Korea suggests that he was relatively tall and relatively healthy by North Korean standards, not so by South Korean standards, because once he got to the operating room, they discovered that he had hepatitis and pneumonia and had a very bad parasitic worm infestation that has not been seen in South Korea since the 1970s.
I suppose that says a lot about the diet in North Korea.
That's right. It was not only the worms that the doctors were horrified by, but the fact that this supposedly elite soldier had raw corn kernels in his stomach when they found him. Wow. So, you know, that was the diet of supposedly a frontline elite soldier in North Korea.
Have we heard anything from North Korea about this escape?
North Korea has not said a thing at all, nothing through their official media about this. The only kind of reaction that we've seen is that soldiers in the DMZ there on the North Korean side have been very busy digging trenches and putting boulders in along the area where their soldier managed to defect, presumably to try and stop anybody else making a run for it across that that patch of land.
And what are people in South Korea saying about this?
I think people are really shocked and in awe of this soldier's bravery to be able to make this literal dash for freedom in this way. And a lot of South Koreans are saying, you know, wishing him well, saying that they hope that he will get better and be able to live, a free life in South Korea. The doctor who treated the soldier, Mr. Oh, has said that he's told him he wants to study law when he gets out of hospital. Mm. So everybody's looking forward to the future for this young man.
Meantime, the U.S. and South Korea are cooperating on Air Force drills during a very tense time with big concerns about North Korea's nuclear capability. What are the U.S. and South Korea doing exactly right now?
Right. So this is a 4-day air combat training mission that's going on. It's the third year in a row that this has happened. And the U.S. Air Force is saying that this has not been done in response to the latest provocations from North Korea, such as its missile test last week. Mm. But this was long planned. But still, you know, the timing is hardly conducive at the moment because we have these talk of war coming out of Washington, or the National Security Advisor, H.R. McMaster, is talking about time is running out for a diplomatic solution here on the peninsula. And then at the same time, we have all of these very high-tech American stealth fighters arriving in South Korea, where together with the South Korean Air Force, they are conducting, you know, simulated drills on North Korean military targets, including nuclear and missile, you know, mock targets, and also practicing, you know, enemy infiltration and all of these kind of maneuvers, which North Korea has denounced as preparation for an invasion.
Anna Fifield with The Washington Post, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me on, Marco.
A city built especially for scientists in the middle of Siberia. That story is up next, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. How do you get thousands of top scientists and academics to move to a place synonymous with oppression and darkness and long winters? In the 1950s, the Soviet Union managed to do that with Siberia by promising the scientists good housing, better food, and interesting work. My BBC colleague Olga Smirnova has a story of Academic City and one Russian scientist who's lived there for decades.
My first impression was that of bewilderment, to be honest. I came here from the city, and everything was different here. The houses were right in the middle of the forest. It was so quiet, and the air seemed so fresh. When snow fell in November, it was white on the ground for one day, 2 days, a week, and for a whole month it remained white. Quite incredible. Normally in the city, snow turns grey or black after a day or two.
Viktor Varand was one of the first scientists to come to Academic City with his wife and small child.
I worked in Academic City for 46 years, since 1962. I was a research chemist at the Institute of Inorganic Chemistry.
A town of 25,000 inhabitants, where nearly everyone's a scientist or hoping to become one. Even in the research institutes, the average age is under 30. A new town called Akadem Gorodok, or Academic City.
In this BBC film from the mid-1960s, the filmmakers could hardly hide their astonishment at the effort that was put into bringing so many scientists to what was initially just an empty spot in the middle of a frozen Siberian forest. So what was the reason for building Academic City in these harsh conditions of Siberia?
There is so much forest here, so many mineral resources. They needed to find all these and learn how to extract them.
And so why 1957? Why was that the right time to build this city devoted to science?
Soviet science had lagged behind in the 1920s and 30s and during the war, because many outstanding scientists, including Nobel Prize winners, had either left the country or were imprisoned. So new scientists were needed.
But Siberia had an image problem.
Since the times of the Tsar, people were exiled to Siberia. Would you exile anyone to a good place? And that was the image of Siberia, that wolves ate people there. Scientists from other parts of Russia were scared to come to Siberia because it was so far from Moscow, from Leningrad. When Academic City was first set up, there were no proper flight connections. You had to travel by train for 3 days to get there from Moscow.
Apart from the university, there were dozens of institutes in Academic City, each specializing in its own field of science and yet working in close proximity to each other. The very first institute in Academic City was the one that dealt with water resources, the Institute of Hydrodynamics. And its director, Mikhail Lavrentiev, was the head of the whole city. Lavrentiev was persuaded to come to Siberia from Moscow. One of the bargaining chips was generous investment in lab equipment.
This is what's called a colliding beam accelerator, the only one of its kind in the world, designed to hurl particles of matter at particles of antimatter.
No, they did not attract us with money. They attracted us with interesting work and housing. Our salary was only 10% more than the others, the so-called Siberian supplement. But they did give us apartments immediately. Separate apartments. At that time, in the USSR, there was an acute shortage of housing. The majority of young people then lived with their parents. Many already had children. And of course, we wanted to be independent from our parents.
And there were food shortages in the USSR, and your position in the academic hierarchy was reflected in the kind of food you had access to.
Academicians and those with doctorate degrees had food delivered to their houses. And academicians had access to better food. They could have caviar and also fruit, a variety of meats and sausages and cheese.
And even ordinary residents ate better in Academic City.
My wife came to Academic City first, before my son and I joined her. And she wrote to us, "They're selling sausages here in the shop in Academic City." I wrote back, "Please send us some sausage." Irkutsk, where we lived then, had problems with food. So my wife sent us parcels with sausages. But food was not that important to us. To begin with, we ate in the canteen. This was quicker. We worked without keeping an eye on the time. We very rarely came home from work before 8 or 9 at night.
What motivated such talented scientists to work such long hours?
We worked without asking too many questions. I just wanted to do something interesting and useful. And that was my motivation.
and the outstanding schooling for children in Academic City was another incentive.
This passion for mathematics is being cultivated in an unusual school in Academic City, which each year recruits the ablest boys and girls from the whole of the Soviet Union. The pupils are chosen by a nationwide competition. It's a kind of forcing house for geniuses.
Oh, very far is deep and wide. Alleluia.
Children singing at the English school.
On the other side.
Alleluia.
This was the very first school in Academic City. From the beginning, it specialized in English. They taught English very thoroughly. My son, Sasha, went there.
And for some academics, there was an option to travel abroad.
I personally didn't go to conferences abroad because I worked on a secret research program. But my wife and many others went abroad. One of my colleagues from the institute went to France to work for a month. And when he came back, he sounded very impressed. What is most amazing is how easy it is to get the necessary chemicals for experiments. You fill out a form and chemicals are delivered within 1 to 3 days from anywhere in Europe. We Soviet chemists found this staggering. At that time, you had to order substances or lab equipment a year in advance.
Academic City was 4 time zones away from Moscow and its party bosses. Did academics working here feel freer in what they thought and said?
People had learned in the 1930s during Stalin's repressions, and of course people kept quiet. We thought one thing, but said something quite different aloud. We did this from experience. Not everyone was brave enough to speak up against the Communist Party.
The thriving local art scene was also nourished by a fascination with jazz. Life in Academic City was full of contradictions. Listening to jazz versus an inability to speak openly. Lavishly funded research equipment versus the need to order chemicals for lab experiments a year in advance. So, was Academic City a success?
Of course, the creation of Academic City was a great achievement. A new generation of scientists has been nurtured here. Most people who work in Academic City now are graduates of our university. And what does Russia live on today? Gas and oil, of course. And who found and explored those resources? Our Siberian scientists.
Scientist Viktor Varand ending that report by the BBC's Olga Smirnova. Varand and his wife still live in Academic City. I'm Marco Werman. When an op-ed in the state-run China Daily said there is no sexual harassment in China, women reacted, like this podcaster in Beijing.
We don't have the Me Too campaign in China, but some people I remember wrote saying that this guy is talking BS.
That story is still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. More accusations of sexual harassment this weekend, accusations against James Levine, the conductor of the Metropolitan Opera, and closer to home, accusations of harassment and bullying against John Hockenberry, former host of The Takeaway, which, like The World, is co-produced by PRI and WGBH. It is sobering, it is angering, but it does feel like people are talking about this differently now, here at home and in many parts of the world, like in China. We called up Yajun Zhang to talk about that.
Hello, this is Yajun.
She's in Beijing, where she co-hosts a podcast called Women, which is spelled in English, W-O-M-E-N, but which means us in Chinese. And on the latest episode, the topic is sexual harassment. Prompted in part by an op-ed in the state-run China Daily that claimed that there is no sexual harassment in China because of its traditional culture.
I can't believe somebody wrote something like that in China Daily and arguing that there's no sexual harassment in China. I personally had this kind of experience, and some of my friends had that kind of experience. So I was really shocked. And later I noticed that this op-ed piece was circulated among friends, especially on WeChat. And, you know, we don't have the Me Too campaign in China, but some people I remember wrote saying that this guy is talking BS. Of course there is sexual harassment.
So tell us, if you would, some of the stories that you've been hearing on your podcast.
There's a bunch of them. For example, like, so we shared two stories that we think can represent some situation in China. One is about a friend who worked in a state-owned company, and she was harassed by one of her actually well-regarded executives in the company who did that in a public event of the company. And when the girl was really shocked, she started to challenge him. He didn't feel ashamed about what he did. He felt like, you know, it's your honor that I think you might be attracted to me. And then later, she shared a story with one of her older female colleagues, who at the end, the female colleague asked her, you know, what kind of clothes did you wear? Oh, did you wear something really sexy? You know, so deep in people's mind, if this kind of thing happened to a woman, people always think it's the girl's problem. Actually, she said, oh, I was wearing something really formal because it's a company event.
Wow.
But my point is, no matter what you wear, other people have no rights to harass you.
Do you think the Weinstein charges and all the subsequent other charges have given Chinese women a kind of a license to be more open and talk about their experiences?
I do. For example, you know, this word, sexual harassment, I'm aware of this word, sex harassment, long time ago, but I never understood, you know, what can be qualified as sexual harassment. Until recently, you know, with what's happening in the U.S., for a long time, I didn't feel that I experienced the sexual harassment because, it's just when I was in college, when I was doing internship, you know, my boss just pat me, you know, saying that, oh, you look really cute. You know, at that moment, I thought, okay, it's just maybe it's a compliment. And then with what's happening in the U.S., I start to read more. And start to realize that actually that was sexual harassment.
Mm. I'm curious to know, too, whether your and other women's attitudes are changing and seeing this differently, or whether something in China has actually changed.
I don't, for example, like in the U.S., people are saying that it's the turning point. I think in China, there's still a long way to go. I do see, you know, among my friends, where more exposed to international affairs. We know what's going on. You know, I do see more and more people have this kind of a realization about gender issue in China. And people do discuss about it privately in Beijing, like in Shanghai. But for China as a whole, I think there's still a long way to go.
I also asked Yajun Zhang how the influence of Western culture might be affecting Chinese views about gender and authority. Here's what she told me.
I'm a post-80 generation. So particularly for our generation, I think, you know, we in this generation have a huge difference from our parents. And we grew up with the so-called Western value and influence. For example, like my favorite show is Sex and City.
Yeah.
I guess, but you have no idea that Sex and the City has a huge impact to me and my friends.
Mm.
I'm not talking about what of a sex position. I'm talking about, you know, girls, you should learn to, you know, chase what you want. You should enjoy your own life, you know, make your own decision. That's the show taught us. So right now, looking around, you know, we watch CNN, we watch Bloomberg, even though we have to use VPN to get that, you know.
Yeah, the virtual private personal network, yeah.
Yeah. When you open the door, you cannot close it anymore.
Yajun Zhang there in Beijing. She's a co-host of a podcast called Woman. Earlier, I mentioned the accusations of harassment and bullying against John Hockenberry, the former host of The Takeaway. Today, The Takeaway, which again is also co-produced by PRI and WGBH, tackled the accusations directly on air. You can read more about that and hear their discussion at PRI.org. During his weekly television broadcast yesterday, President Nicolas Maduro of Venezuela introduced a new digital currency.
El Petro se va a llamar. El San Petro.
Maduro is calling it the Petro, and the point of this new digital currency, according to Maduro, is to allow Venezuela to get around an array of U.S.-led economic sanctions. But how exactly? Well, Maduro offered few details. So for more, we turn to Andrew Rosati, a reporter for Bloomberg News in Caracas.
It's a cryptocurrency, and it's basically the Venezuelan version of the Bitcoin. Now, there's very few details have been given out so far, and we're all kind of wondering. But the big hope is that they'll be able to get cash and payments abroad, since they're having trouble with U.S. sanctions paying for things like their bonds or other creditors, that they'll be able to circumvent the sanctions. But they haven't said just exactly how they're going to do it yet, so we're waiting for detail.
Now, the Petro, it's backed by oil reserves. Are those global oil reserves or just Venezuela's reserves?
They're just Venezuela reserves. And they also said that they're going to back it things like with gold and other diamonds, that there are things that there are technically a lot of in Venezuela. The problem is that many of these things are backed on faith. You know, coming from the Venezuelan government, there's a lot of skepticism here. You know, the government is, you know, up to its neck in debt. The people are thinking the default is imminent. I think many investors or potential would be very skeptical accepting some fresh currency from Venezuela.
The global price of oil dropped to a big degree in the last decade. I mean, and that's in large part why Venezuela's got this current crisis. What do the experts think? Do they think this is going to work?
No, there's a huge amount of skepticism around this. One of the big problems that got Venezuela into this mess are these controls and Byzantine restrictions they have on their own currencies. You can't just go to the bank and get dollars here. You have to go through these government exchanging houses or the central bank. It's a huge amount of red tape. And this giving another new currency and not opening up the controls, it seems like even more of a headache here. So the fact that they're suddenly like, okay, we're going to bring out this new currency, the last system didn't work, no one's really excited by this. I think that what many economists are saying is that they need to open up their markets, but we haven't seen a big effort to do so.
Yeah, so economists are skeptical. What about Venezuelans who are going to have to presumably use this currency? What do they think?
Well, if you look at the there's so many problems day to day in Venezuela, just by getting cash out to make basic transactions. There's long lines in the banks. Then once you actually get a handful of cash to go and spend it, you know, there's scarcities of products and, you know, everything from chicken to car parts. So when someone brings up this idea of a new currency, I think, you know, this hasn't really registered for a lot of Venezuelans yet because there's so many problems on the day to day just getting through the grind.
Is the traditional currency, the bolivar, still legal tender, though?
Well, the bolivar is the legal tender, but hyperinflation in Venezuela has, you know, rendered it practically worthless. A dollar here goes for about over 100,000 bolivars in the black market.
So just on the practical side, how do Venezuelans pay for stuff? I mean, if you go out and buy a jar of peanut butter, you have to take a whole bag of cash with you?
What has happened in Venezuela is that because prices are rising so fast in the midst of hyperinflation, there is not enough cash to go around to make local purchases. Anything you can, you pay for with a debit or credit card or a bank transfer. But there's always these things you have to pay for, whether it's a parking garage, a taxi, or buying from a fruit stand. The lines in the bank will go out the door to get scarce cash. You can spend an hour, 2 hours to get some cash, and then it's gone in a matter of seconds.
Wow.
Going out for a meal, like at a nice restaurant, will hundreds of thousands of bolivars to get a massive type of cash here that could, you know, fill a suitcase in the smallest denominations. The government has released some newer bills, but there's just not enough to go around. Everything is being pushed towards electronic transfers or through plastic. You just can't get around it. And there's actually been a growing market for cash itself because, you know, there's not enough cash to go around. No one wants to stand in the banks. So people are, you know, whether they're store owners or people that make a business of it, they're actually buying cash to use later. So it's this kind of big downward spiral because of inflation is going up so fast.
What about you, Andrew? If you were investing in currencies, how risky an investment would purchasing Petros be?
I think it'd be extremely risky right now, given the government's or the Venezuelan track record, and, you know, lots of people, whether it be in airlines or, you know, oil service providers, have lost a lot of money investing in Venezuela in the past few years. So a new cryptocurrency, it sounds like a very risky business to me.
Andrew Rosati, a reporter with Bloomberg News, speaking with us from Caracas. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Marco.
President Trump flew to Utah today to roll back federal protections on land there. The order he signed shrinks the boundaries for two national monuments in the state, Bears Ears National Monument in the southeastern part of Utah and the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument in the southwestern part of the state. The World's Livable Planet reporter Carolyn Beeler has been following this. So President Trump was expected to shrink these two national monuments, and he did, but by how much?
So Bears Ears National Monument, the one in southeastern Utah, which President Obama formed just about a year ago, was about 1.35 million acres, and President Trump has just shrunk that by nearly 90%. So he's also split that land into two different areas. The Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, which has been around for about two decades, is going from 1.7 million acres to about half that size.
So this is in line with other moves by the Trump administration to open new oil and gas leasing opportunities in protected lands and roll back protections for endangered species. What is the goal with this move?
President Trump framed this really as a states' rights issue and said that these large designations of land as national monuments sort of unnecessarily restricts the way that residents and people who live nearby can use the land. He said that with this, quote, public lands once again will be for public use.
Some people think that the natural resources of Utah should be controlled by a small handful of very distant bureaucrats located in Washington. And guess what? They're wrong.
So, Marco, the designation of Bears Ears has been quite controversial among Republican lawmakers in Utah, so this move is sure to make them happy as well. These lands that have been declassified as national monuments could now be opened up to coal, oil, and natural gas leasing. But at least in Bears Ears, this sort of most controversial monument, nobody on either side of the issue really thinks that's going to happen anytime soon because oil and gas development there is not economically feasible, at least right at this moment.
As you said, Carolyn, Bears Ears was just named a national monument by Obama under a year ago. What's been the reaction from the people who pushed for it to be created in the first place?
I will answer that in one word, Marco: lawsuit. The five Native American tribes that pushed for the creation of Bears Ears in the first place are ready to submit papers like right now on this. Their argument hinges on the 1906 Antiquities Act, which gives presidents the authority to create national monuments, but does not explicitly give them the authority to shrink the borders of an already instated monument or change a monument in any way. The lawyers that are going to be arguing this also argue that a 1970s law reiterated that stance. And in fact, no president's change to the borders of a national monument has been challenged in court. So there is some open space here for them to argue that it's not legal. Likewise, environmental nonprofits plan to challenge the Grand Escalante National Monument change as well. So it's not just Bears Ears that's likely to be stuck in litigation here.
If it doesn't look like oil and natural gas drilling will be coming to Bears Ears anytime soon, what are the Native American tribes that are there? What are they worried about happening?
Well, I asked this to the lawyer representing some of the tribes that are going to be challenging this order, Natalie Landreth, and here's what she told me.
Our understanding is this is the densest archaeological location in the United States when taken as a whole. There are over 100,000 archaeological sites in Bears Ears, and they're going to leave them all unprotected. And they would open it up to widespread looting, which has been a major problem in this area.
Protecting these tribes' historical and spiritual history is the reason why they banded together to get this designation in the first place. So they're worried that President Trump's announcement's going to leave this land open again to exploitation.
Wow, another big shift from the Trump White House. The World's Carolyn Beeler, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
You know, we've been following the humanitarian crisis in Yemen, 10,000 people killed in the civil war there, and 17 million people, two-thirds of the population, without enough to eat. And this morning, our newsroom saw some unexpected news, a video widely shared of a man's body being carried on a blanket. He was identified as the most powerful man in Yemen, the former president Ali Abdullah Saleh. We called up someone who knows all about him, Alma Abdulhadi Jadala. She teaches conflict resolution at George Mason University, but we caught up with her in Beirut. Bear with us. The phone line was not great.
He ruled with an iron fist.
With an iron fist, she says. Jadala told us about Saleh's 40-year career in Yemen as a military leader, a politician, a power broker, and by some accounts, a ruthless killer.
Ironically, he's a very personable person. He doesn't look very aggressive, but when you read his history, he's quite a personality in terms of what he had done to the country.
Saleh opened up Yemen's oil fields, really developed the energy sector, but then he used the profits for bribes and to build a network of powerful friends. He also made a lot of enemies. He even talked about it, said he could outmaneuver his rivals as if he were dancing on the heads of snakes.
And so it is true. The snakes that were around him and trying to either bite him and do him harm, he has always survived. He had the ability to work with his enemies when he needed and get rid of them when he needed to do that.
His personal wealth was hard to measure, but Amma Jadala told me that she and a UN team of experts got close in 2015.
At the time, the guesstimate was $60 billion and above.
$60 billion with a B.
At the time, that the first billion, yes.
Rich, powerful, and over the past 3 years, the leader of one side in the Yemeni civil war. His death, says Amma Jadala, is a big deal. 4 days ago, he surprised many Yemen watchers when he turned his back on his allies in the Yemen civil war, the militant religious group known as the Houthis. And 4 days ago, he switched sides and threw his support to Saudi Arabia, which is battling the Houthis with U.S. support. One more example of dancing on the heads of snakes. Since then, the streets of the Yemeni capital Sana'a have become a battlefield. And today, Ali Abdullah Saleh became the most famous war casualty. Exactly who killed him is still murky, says Jadala.
We don't know the real details of what has happened, but he has been a very much sought after target. And so there probably are a lot of people who may have had an interest in him going away.
Fighting on the ground continues, and as fighter jets flown by the Saudi coalition continue to drop bombs on Yemen, the United Nations and other international groups have been trying to get their staff members out. Most people in Yemen don't have that option. Jadala says the bombing and the Saudi blockade that keeps food and medicine from getting into Yemen, she says those have to stop.
It is really unforgivable that the Yemeni people and the Yemeni children and women and the blockade has caused so much for the Yemeni people.
Perhaps the best we can do is point you to a list of humanitarian groups that will be bringing food and medicine to Yemen as soon as it is safe. You can find that list at PRI.org. Migrants, immigrants, refugees. These words mean different things to different people. Here's another one, expat.
This is a word I avoid using.
That's Patrick Cox of our language podcast, The World in Words. So expatriates, people from country X living in country Y. What's wrong with expat, Patrick?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, it's code for privileged white English speakers who choose to move abroad, who choose to live in another country, and they do so at a remove. They're not required to assimilate. You could just search the word expat on YouTube. You get something like this.
Estimated that roughly 50 million people around the world were expatriates.
What if an expat is simply a person who lives?
Living life as an expat can give us great opportunities.
In this interview with expats in Mexico.
All right, Patrick, I get it. So, expatriate, where did the word come from anyway? It's Latin, right?
Yeah, right. Expatria, out of one's country. It's been around in the English language for centuries, but its meaning has narrowed in more recent times to suggest, you know, a person of means and privilege who chooses to move from one country to another, which kind of makes it the opposite of refugee, where there isn't any choice. And it got me thinking, this idea of a high-status migrant, I wondered if that existed in other languages.
It doesn't have an equivalent. Nothing. We don't have a word for expat.
This is Kavork Bardakjian. He's a professor of Armenian languages and literatures at the University of Michigan. Armenians historically have traveled the world. And in the 16th and 17th centuries, Bardakjian told me there was a class of Armenians who just might have been called expats. They were wealthy people who established trade routes all the way from China to Western Europe.
They traveled, and some of them settled, especially merchants who traded in jewelry or diamonds. A preferred place for them was Amsterdam. And there was a community of a few hundred Armenians who sort of almost lived there. Eventually, many of them stayed there.
All right, wealthy businessmen, travelers by choice, didn't really assimilate. Sounds pretty similar to expat. What were they called?
They were called merchants. And I'm not going to try and pronounce that word in Armenian. It doesn't sound especially problematic, maybe, but in its own way, it conveyed much of what the term expat does today. So I contacted specialists in some other languages, and again, I couldn't find a word that is currently in use that is the equivalent of expat.
Yeah, maybe some of you listening can tell us what words you know of in other languages that describe this thing abroad.
Right, that would be great. And for the most part, though, it does seem to be a largely English-speaking phenomenon. And I think a little bit more freighted with the colonial past for us Brits than it is for you Yanks, Marco. Mm.
Yeah, no surprise there.
And just when I was totally giving up on the word, I came across Régine Jean-Charles. She's at Boston College, a professor of French literature who specializes in the versions of French that are spoken in the former colonies. We chatted about a bunch of terms like immigrants and refugees, how there are different shades of semantic nuance for all of these words from one place to another. And then she said this.
My family is from Haiti, and my kids have no grandparents here because they've all gone back to their country. And that was always the plan. So my parents were Haitian expats.
Ah, so she used the word.
And I got really excited when she did. It was like she was reclaiming this word that isn't normally associated with Haitians.
Yeah, go on. Co-opt that term. Yeah. Use that term.
What I should have said, right?
Never said that before.
No. Never.
Well, Patrick, you may not like the word, but it sounds like Régine and others around the world are going to keep breathing life into the word expatriate. So the latest episode of our language podcast, The World in Words, takes on expat and also traces the history of the word assimilation. You can listen to it wherever you hear your podcasts or at pri.org/language. Patrick Cox, as always, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Marco.
That's all the time we've got today. I'm Marco Werman, back with you tomorrow from the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston.
PRI, Public Radio International.